Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaca. We are dedicating this week's episode to Valentine's Day, but rest assured, this is not going to be an overly sappy episode. Whether you love or hate Valentine's Day, you will definitely love this episode, which starts right now. Here at Real College Podcast, we're always tackling the really important issues, and Valentine's Day is no exception. That's why this year we decided to have a debate and decide once and for all what the best romantic comedy of all time is.
Hello, one and all. We are going to be deciding today what is the best romantic comedy. We have four worthy competitors, and we have three godlike judges. So here we go. We're going to start the debate.
My name is Jacob Qualzak, and the movie I will be debating today is The Princess Bride. Now, I know it might be a bit of a curveball to throw The Princess Bride as one of the best romantic comedies of all time, but I would argue that it is one of the best romantic comedies of all time. Not only that, but I think it's one of the better movies of all time. This is the only romantic comedy that I can think of that can be considered a classic movie. That's because of how universal it is. It's filled with charm, wit, romance, and all of that goes without saying about how it's pretty much the most quotable movie of all time. I love this movie. Your mom loves this movie. Your niece loves this movie. Everyone loves this movie. It's timeless. My parents watched this when they were younger. I watched this when I was younger. My kids are going to be able to watch this and enjoy it as well. Now, obviously, romantic comedy probably isn't the first genre you think of when you think of The Princess Bride, but I would argue it is. It's one of the greatest love stories of all time, and it's filled with comedy. In fact, Rotten Tomatoes rates it as its number 10 best romantic comedy of all time. The reason why you might not immediately put it in the same category as rom-coms is because of how formulaic and generic a lot of rom-coms are. Now, The Princess Bride kind of goes above and beyond that formulaic nature and provides its own timeless movie of its own. It's a romantic comedy at its core, and it's a hilarious fantasy adventure centered around a story of true love.
So, Jacob, you said the movie has a lot of, you know, twists and turns. It's not your basic, simple love story. What if that's too difficult for me? How am I going to follow? Like, how am I going to understand that love?
Actually, I think that brings me to my next point, which is that The Princess Bride, out of all these movies, and out of any movie I've really seen, is the only one that encapsulates true love. All these other ones, these loves have doubt, they have conflict, they have all this other thing between the couples themselves. In this movie, the biggest conflict is for Cary Elwes trying to get to Princess Buttercup, because there's nothing in the world that can separate their true love. There's no mountain that he can't overcome to get there, even though there are mountains standing in their way.
I'm Sophia Hahn, and I'm going to be arguing that 10 Things I Hate About You is the best romantic comedy you've ever seen. So we're going to talk about some pretty iconic romantic comedies today. We've got Jacob with The Princess Bride, Jaca with My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and Molly with The Proposal. And I'm not arguing that they aren't memorable and in their own way iconic movies. However, they are lacking when compared to the underdog of modern romantic comedy, 10 Things I Hate About You. 10 Things just rises above when it comes to the most classic tenets of a romantic comedy. There's both romance and comedy in excess. While most of these movies contain only one romantic relationship, 10 Things tracks multiple relationships and follows them through more realistic paths than like any other romantic comedy that we're going to talk about today. These relationships are full of heart and hope and connect the audience back to their own high school romances. But of course, such relationships are in and of themselves hilarious, and through some of the most quotable lines of this genre, this film allows such hilarity to unfold. Not only that, 10 Things I Hate About You has an all-star cast. It's got Heath Ledger before he became known on the Hollywood radar with things like The Dark Knight or Brokeback Mountain. It has Julia Stiles, who is shining as Kat Stratford. And it has baby Joseph Gordon-Levitt, which is always adorable. Beyond that, it defies the normal stereotype of what a romantic comedy is. It follows William Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, but in its own late 1990s take. And it has emotion and humor in excess. It is one of the best movies ever. 10 Things I Hate About You it's a movie for all, it's loved by all, and it deserves to be recognized by all.
The Taming of the Shrew is one of Shakespeare's more misogynistic plays. How do you think that 10 Things I Hate About You kind of subverses this?
Well, I think 10 Things I Hate About You puts itself as different than what you're saying is a more misogynistic play. Because if you have seen the movie, you'll know that Kat Stratford does not take anything from any man or anybody for that matter. And honestly, this movie, I think, really goes against the rom-com stereotype of the whole manic pixie dream girl thing, because both of them change in the end. It's not just him overpowering her and putting her into a relationship. They're both working together. And the same is true for the other relationships in this movie.
My name is Jaka, and I will be arguing that My Big Fat Greek Wedding is one of the best rom-coms of all time. It's not one that everybody's seen, and I totally acknowledge that, but it's one that everybody should see. The biggest thing that I think sets this movie apart is the fact that it's multicultural. You're following a Greek girl falling in love with a white guy, and sort of the difficulties that comes from that. That in and of itself relates to a larger audience and really draws in people who maybe don't see themselves represented in rom-coms. And the family in it is loud and eccentric, and that's something that a lot of people can relate to and find funny. And a lot of the humor in this movie comes not just from the relationship, but from the family. And family plays such a central role that I think that this movie goes beyond a rom-com to be a family movie. And it's really important in that sense. I also would argue that the main character, Tula, she is a feminist in her own right, because she has the classic rom-com makeover, but she does it herself, and it's not just a makeover. It is a complete life overhaul. She goes to school to improve her life, and after that, once she's comfortable with herself, then she's ready to find love. There are many quotable lines from this movie, like the fact that the dad thinks that Windex fixes everything. Any ailment you have can be fixed with Windex. And so I think that My Big Fat Greek Wedding offers a different perspective on the rom-com, offers a multicultural look at it, and really is just very inclusive.
Okay, Jaka, it's on now for you. My question for you is similar to one I had for Jacob. You said this movie has a lot of family. What if I hate families?
Well, listen, Alex, I can't help but notice that you are white. So the family in this movie... Hear me out. The family in this movie is Greek. So even if you hate your family, this family's different. This is a different culture. And if it's not yours and you hate your family, then I think you'll be just fine.
So you are claiming that it is a very diverse and open movie, but by having the father represent such strong stereotypes, are the writers at fault for doing that, or do you think that just adds to the movie's quality?
Yeah, so I think that it's intentional on the writer's part. I think that it was. I can admit that sometimes playing up stereotypes is heavy-handed, but the writers in this case allow the father to grow. He grows throughout the movie. He starts one way, and by the end of the movie, he's changed his mind, and he is happy that his daughter has married this non-Greek man. And so I think that it's just a beautiful example of growth and change within a character.
My name is Molly Nelson, and I am going to argue for The Proposal, a truly classic rom-com with a little twist. So picture this. You are immersed into the world of Margaret Tate and Andrew Paxton, going on a wild journey to try and save Margaret from being deported to Canada. Margaret Tate, played by Sandra Bullock, is a hard-nosed boss that has a little hidden soft side, which really can only be brought out through a spontaneous trip to Alaska. Classic rom-com. And Andrew Paxton, played by Ryan Reynolds, sexy and funny, clearly a rom-com guy, makes a deal with Margaret to get married to prevent her from being deported and then get divorced as soon as possible. Not so romantic sounding, right? Well, wrong. After meeting Andrew's family in Alaska and going on several goofy adventures like Betty White, Gammy, taking Margaret to the only strip club in Alaska, to Andrew accidentally throwing Margaret over the side of a boat in anger, to the classic run-of-the-mill, seemingly soulmate ex-girlfriend. Throughout the film, we see opposites attract in action, and as Margaret and Andrew slowly start to fall for each other, and the end leaves you on the edge of your seat as Margaret backs out and shows her sensitive side by not really wanting to ruin Andrew's family. And so she takes one for the team and decides to get deported. But Betty White steps in to save the day, clearly, and she fakes a heart attack, and that gets Andrew to the airport. He reunites with Margaret. It's just all wonderful, and it ends with a big dramatic kiss in the office back in New York. And it just leaves you on a good note where everything's reunited, and yeah, I just feel like this whole movie really flows. There's no forced humor, and it's just a classic good love story.
Okay, Molly, at the beginning of the film, our two protagonists have differing levels in their social and economic circles. But by the end, the intern, or the lower class, has decided to accept their position. What do you think this movie says about capitalist hierarchies?
I think if we really kind of dive deep into the beginning of this film, we are placed in Andrew's life where he's really struggling to, like, get higher in the ranks of this business, and he gave up everything, moving far away from his family, wanting to pursue his writing career. And frankly, just having this blockade of kind of a mean boss, if you'd say, not letting him advance, really just kind of puts a damper on the movie. But then throughout the movie, she starts to see his true quality. And I think it's also good because at the end, she realizes and reforms her ways.
So a couple things I wanted to touch on first would be the cast. I'd say not only did we get a star-studded cast in The Princess Bride, but we also got a cast at their peak. So a lot of the actors in my movie, I would argue, played their best roles in this movie, like Cary Elwes, like Mandy Patinkin, like Wallace Shawn. When you see him in other things, you think, oh, that's the guy who says inconceivable. We get to see Andre the Giant. We got to see his comedic chops before it was too late, which was really nice. Billy Crystal's even in that movie, who is one of the funniest actors that I've ever seen. And he doesn't even play that big of a role in the movie, but every time he's on the screen, he steals the show. So when you don't even have to rely on the comedic chops of Billy Crystal to make your movie as funny as it is, I feel like that really goes to show the cleverness of the writing and directing and other actors.
I would also like to touch on the aspect of casts. I kind of hinted at it earlier, but while you mentioned that with Princess Bride, the cast was at their peak, I would argue that they peaked, like they were done after that point. 10 Things I Hate About You really captured this cast at the beginning. They had to prove themselves. They were ready to prove their acting abilities. And 10 Things I Hate About You really gave them that platform because, like I mentioned, it had them it had them deal with a really wide range of emotion. There was that comedic aspect of them trying to get the girl and just the hilarity that can ensue with that. But then there was also the raw emotion. I challenge anybody to watch Julia Stiles read her 10 Things I Hate About You poem, because it'll make you cry. But it'll make you cry because you recognize the love that exists. Thus, the two major components for a romantic comedy. And that's not even the only romantic connection. There is Patrick Verona, played by Heath Ledger, and Julia Stiles' character of Kat Stratford. There is Bianca Stratford and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. There is the guy from Santa Claus movies and the Shakespeare girl. There's so many romantic connections, and there's laughter throughout the whole thing. And I think that that is what makes it the best romantic comedy.
The first thing I'd like to say is we're really spending a lot of time talking about what actors are in the movie, but I think that more importantly than that, it's the story told and the way that it's delivered, regardless of the actors. And My Big Fat Greek Wedding, while it may not have some of the fancier actors, it delivers a great story regardless and gives opportunities to actors you may not see in other movies, which is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
It's a very funny movie that starts off with two people trying to blackmail each other. And you just, like, go through this whole conflict of, like, right and wrong. And, you know, I just think you're just taken on a journey of basically just, like, two people bickering the whole time but then falling in love. And I just think it's a good classic feel-good movie at the end. And, you know, my peers here are laughing at me as I am saying this. I feel like that should take off a few points. This is clearly a professional environment. And anyways, I really feel like no matter if it's the best movie that Sandra Bullock or Ryan Reynolds have made, if it's not, they did a really good job in this film, and I think that just shows their true acting ability to take even the most basic and average rom-com and turn it into something special.
Okay, the judges are now going to deliberate. Do we want to just do a quick, everyone run down what order they would put them in and kind of why? Okay, I guess I would throw Jacob at first. I think in terms of, like, why it was the best romantic comedy, he kind of had the most coherent, like, these are the different reasons. I think Proposal comes in second. She really defended her movie at every turn and really sold it as a romantic comedy. I think Jacob in third. And then, unfortunately, I think 10 Things I Hate About You comes in fourth.
All right, this is tough. I do agree that the proposal was very eloquent in all of her responses, including the one about the capitalist hierarchy in dealing with socioeconomic infiltration. So what I would have to say is I do agree with a lot of Jacob's arguments in the fact that no one really considers The Princess Bride, that's not the immediate rom-com. And normally when people think immediate rom-com, it's normally negative stereotypes like girl meets boy, everyone's white, it's in some city like New York or something. But I'd have to say that Jacob is probably first, and then I'd go with Jacob, The Proposal, and I think 10 Things I Hate About You.
So I would say that in terms of debating, I would actually say Sophia did the best. I think I wasn't too into just the idea of the movie 10 Things I Hate About You, but she really sold it to me. While I'm not so familiar with some of the others, I do think she made me feel more familiar with it and made the case. So I would put her first. Second, I would probably, can I tie?
Yeah.
Okay, second, I would tie, Jacob with The Princess Bride and Jaca with My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And I'm sorry to say, but I would put The Proposal last.
So for the bottom, it was a tie between 10 Things I Hate About You and The Proposal.
Second place, we have My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
And in first place, although it wasn't my favorite, was Jacob with The Princess Bride.
A big thank you to Jacob, Sophia, Molly, Charter, and Hannah for helping out with the debate and making it a good experience, even if some of the movies were robbed of their title. I'm not going to say which one. Extra special thank you to Alex for organizing the whole thing, even though, once again, he was a poor judge, but he put in a lot of work. Next up, we have an original story that appeared in The Wake magazine. It was written by Aubrey Aselson, which is a name you should remember because it'll be a big one someday, mark my words. She came in and read her story, Dollhouse.
She was his wife before she was really a woman. His, right away, the third day of sophomore year when he leaned against her locker so she couldn't get in it and looked at her like he knew he'd had her. The crawling look in his eyes made her heart beat hard and she held her books across her checks so that he wouldn't see. Every day for 3 years she waited for him outside his last class, doodling hearts on her palms and wrists and smiling viciously at the girls that stopped to tell her, "You guys, like, belong together." She poured herself into him and told her mother that she would marry him when she was done with school, welcoming the tender way her mother touched her face. She was his, too, the night she sneaked out of the siding back door after her parents had fallen asleep. She went to his truck and clutched him to her as he split her open, and she thought that to be loved like this was to be broken a little. She gasped at the pain and smiled at the ceiling of the truck as he breathed into her neck. Later, she returned home and sat in front of the dollhouse her father had bought her when she was younger and he was kinder. The house was clasped shut and she squeezed one eye closed tight and peered through each window and door until she had seen the entire gut of the thing, every piece in place as she left it. There are pictures and pretty albums of the two of them at graduation. She's wearing a blue scallop dress and he is gripping her waist and kissing her cheek. It was only a month later that she found out she was pregnant. He asked her to marry him, and his father gave him a job and a house in the suburbs. She returned to her parents' home the day after she told her mother about the baby and found her things spread across the lawn. She picked up her sweaters and books and old homework assignments and placed them carefully in the truck she now shared with him. She found the dollhouse on its side in the grass, and she picked it up carefully, held it steady in the passenger seat as she drove to their new home. She became his wife when she was 18, the mother of his child when she was 19. She loved her baby, the smooth, doll-like face, and hated to put it down. He had to rip it out of her arms to put it to sleep. When she felt him fall asleep at night, she would creep into the nursery and hold the baby close, crying into its soft head. The chubby hands began to pull at her over time, yanking her hair until her eyes watered, and one day she took a pair of scissors and cut the long curls until they looped next to her skull. She became his wife again and again. Every morning she handed him a travel mug of coffee, steeped in cream and sugar, and he kissed her on the cheek as he left for work. She would spend the day drifting about the house with the baby in her arms until the baby grew into a child and she watched the yellow bus lurch around the corner away from her every day, walked home alone. She scrubbed the shining surfaces of the house and set out ingredients for the dinner she'd make later, then put them in the refrigerator so they wouldn't go bad. Once she caught her reflection in the faucet and thought she saw wrinkles on her smooth young skin. And then she forgot to pick up the child from the bus stop. They called him at work, and he returned from the office early with a distrustful look in his eyes. She thought she felt something unravel inside her. She pictured herself falling, breaking open and spilling over the linoleum. Just before the sun rose one morning, she slipped out from under his arm and under his breath, which held a lingering scent of alcohol. She padded down the hall in her slippers, stopping outside the child's room for a moment and squeezing one eye shut to peek through the crack in the door. She could see the tuft of yellow hair sticking up from the pillow and smiled to herself before drifting down the hall and out the back door.
When it comes to romance, we often talk about finding that one special person. But love doesn't need to be solely amongst two people. Real College Podcast reporter Austin Maclis explores how some people have intimate relationships that aren't exclusive.
I have never really felt comfortable in monogamous relationships because it always felt like each partner in the relationship was expected to be, to like meet every standard and every need of their other partner, and that never made me feel comfortable.
That's Jasmine. She's currently a college student in Minneapolis. Around 2 or 3 years ago, Jasmine began seeing multiple romantic partners at the same time.
I was originally someone who didn't really see myself with a partner in the first place, and then I was like, oh, you can like allow for more people to love you in ways that like you want to be loved.
Jasmine practices consensual non-monogamy, a broad term that encompasses a range of agreements among romantic partners, with varying levels of physical and emotional intimacy. According to estimates by researchers at the University of Michigan, 4 to 5% of all relationships fall under this category.
When it comes down to defining it, I think it really just comes down to being able to find different kinds of intimacy with different people.
For Jasmine, it was a natural fit.
I get a lot of joy out of it. I feel very loved. I get my needs filled from so many people who are like willing to share intimacy with me, and that like is very exciting and validating.
She said she's comfortable with polyamory, having multiple romantic partners simultaneously, or an open relationship, having sexual partners in addition to a primary partner. Although Jasmine is currently in a monogamous relationship, she's been discussing with her partner about opening it up. Angela, a 20-year-old Minneapolis resident, goes back and forth between open relationships and monogamous partners.
Like if my partner wants to be in an open relationship, I'd be very open to that. If my partner wants to be monogamous, I'd be very open to that. I feel like a lot of structures work for me.
When Angela started seeing multiple partners around 2 years ago, she admits she wasn't open to the idea at first.
It's been an interesting journey when it comes to like understanding what relationships are supposed to look like. I think more than anything, it's come down to like unlearning what the structure of what we're taught a relationship is supposed to look like. Being non-monogamous has taught me more than anything else that there are like very different ways to love people, and all of those ways are very valid.
The key to these relationships is agreement. Jasmine explains that she and her partners set the guidelines of their relationship together.
I came into non-monogamy understanding that like you're allowed to like basically create the rules of your own relationships and be able to decide what partner meets what needs or like what ways you want to love and all of those different aspects of relationships.
Because of this, communication is vital.
Especially non-monogamous relationships, it's like everyone needs to be on the same page at all times. Like every single conversation we have is like, are you comfortable with this? What kind of relationship would you like to have? Like what kind of boundaries do you want to set?
According to Dr. Harris, a marriage and family therapist at the University of Minnesota, communication is essential to any type of relationship.
It's important for people to be able to communicate with each other. The biggest challenge for many people is in how do I deal with the things that are being communicated to me. One of the biggest things is really just understanding where your partner's coming from.
Non-monogamy is becoming more acceptable for a growing number of people, especially young people. A 2016 poll found that over a third of young people think consensual non-monogamy is acceptable, much higher than older generations.
Yeah, I know a surprisingly large amount of people who are non-monogamous.
And Jasmine has found that communication is getting better.
I think people are just becoming more comfortable in talking about it.
But despite its prevalence, there are still some major stigmas. Many people think it's only about physicality.
I think non-monogamy and polyamory often gets glued to sexual intimacy, and everybody thinks that's what it's all about. But there are different types of intimacies that exist, and every relationship is built off of like those different intimacies, and you can share different kinds with different people.
For Jasmine, although sexual intimacy is important, it isn't everything.
affection and emotional intimacy are really important to me. So I think a lot of times I look for people who are just like more willing to like communicate their emotions with me.
Perhaps one of the biggest misconceptions is about jealousy.
I'm a jealous person, and I think a lot of people think that being non-monogamous means that you've let go of the ability to feel jealousy, which is like not true at all.
She explains that jealousy is a natural part of non-monogamous relationships, but it can be worked out through talking, openness, and honesty between partners.
I find myself being a lot more secure in my relationships now that I have chosen non-monogamy because I feel like I can bring things up more easily and I can talk about fears and I can talk about my like desires. It's work, but every relationship is a lot of work.
For both Jasmine and Angela, non-monogamous relationships are much like other ones. One of the only differences is they don't think their parents would understand. When I asked Jasmine and Angela if they'd told their family, this was their answer.
Do your parents know about this?
God, no. Oh, no.
Absolutely not.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Austin Maglis.
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It is produced by Alex Schumacher, Emily Allen, and Liv Riggins. I am your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and head over to radiok.org/realcollegepodcast to hear all our previous episodes, and make sure you tune in every Monday at 6:30 for new episodes.